We're in the book of Ephesians, and in the final chapter, I want to invite you to turn to Ephesians chapter 6 this morning. We are asking God to grow us as a healthy church so that we can glorify Him and grow up into Christ our head. These are our themes this year. This morning, a passage that talks about spiritual servants and masters. We've been talking about the worthy walk, a way of living that is worthy of, corresponding to the calling that the first three chapters of Ephesians talks about, all that God has done for us through Christ so that His glory might, through the ages, to humans, to spiritual beings alike, redound to the glory of God. So part of the worthy walk is a spirit-filled walk. And a spirit-filled walk involves an idea, an attitude of submission one to another among God's people. So we've looked at how that applies. In terms of marriage, there is a spiritual marriage between the church and Christ, metaphorically speaking, and when we're spirit-filled, that makes a difference in how we walk in our earthly marriages for those that are married. The Bible talks about a spiritual family, having God as your father, Christ as your brother, others in Christ as your spiritual siblings. And when you recognize that identity, that impacts the way that you behave at home in the spirit-filled family situation between parents and children, the first four verses of chapter 6. The Bible also talks about spiritual servanthood, what it means to have Christ as your master and see yourself as His slave, and that is a spiritual relationship that really impacts the way that we approach life and would have an impact on the way we approach our earthly masters in the workplace and other positions where we are under authority. So these are five verses that deal with spiritual or spirit-filled servants, spiritual or spirit-filled masters. And so let's read, and I just want to read, starting with the first nine verses of verse 5. Servants, be obedient to them that are your masters. Now these are kind of charged words. You know, they could kind of ignite a response, trigger an alarm, a reaction from us. Because what we have to do is really cross a long cultural bridge and a contextual bridge. This is written about 6,000 miles from Indianapolis and about 2,000 years from where we are right now. And so you can read words like that. If you just stop right there, it's like, you know, people talk about being on the right side of history, and it's like, wow, is that on the right side of history? Because even that word servants, some of you heard the Greek word doulos. It's the idea of a slave, really a household slave is what's being, the people that are being addressed here. And so when it comes to being on the right side of history, you know, that means different things to different people. We have to recognize we aren't always. The Bible is always. First century Ephesus wasn't always. Okay, so when we read these words, it's important before we dive into what these instructions are and how they apply to us to kind of cross that contextual bridge and understand some things about the conditions of the people that Paul's writing to. What kind of conditions were they under, and how do they compare to our conditions today, and what comes to our mind when we think of servants or slaves and masters and some of the, you know, those really unfortunate and typically unethical relationships that were just a reality for many parts of the world today and many parts of history at various places. So conditions, from better or worse. If you take the first century Greco-Roman slave, these are the people in Paul's audience. Their conditions were considerably better than what we know from historic American slavery, but their conditions were considerably worse than like our modern American employment. So it's important to understand that kind of nested between, you know, when we think of slaves and masters, like we have so much baggage from our own nation's tragic history. And then in our modern American employment, so many advantages. So the first century Greco-Roman slave that would have been in Paul's audience enjoyed better conditions. I'm not saying good conditions, better conditions than historic American slavery in ways like this. First century Greco-Roman bondservant or household slave could earn wages, could potentially earn his or her freedom, could own land, could excel in different fields of study. Some were better educated even than their masters. Some history tells us about, you know, slaves in this context that were tutors or even philosophers or physicians or things like this, and even some accounts of people voluntarily selling themselves into this type of arrangement because of debt, because they might get better care, because they might attach themselves to a prominent family, or even some other interesting scenarios that history records that we don't have time to get into. Of course, there were also abuses. There were mistreatments, and generally, those in this social class, as they were seen in this context, were dehumanized. So it wasn't a good situation. I'm not trying to say that. It's not defensible. It's not ideal. It's not ethical. But we could say maybe tolerable, bearable. If you found yourself in this situation and couldn't get out, and that's kind of Paul's, you know, approach. He's just addressing the reality of his world. If you find yourself in this situation and you can't get out, here is a spirit-filled way to behave. All right, so Paul is writing not as a social revolutionary, but as a spiritual reformer, and he gives the instructions in 1 Corinthians 7 that if you are called or saved while a slave, don't concern yourself with that because you are the Lord's freed man. If you are spiritually freed, that is the most important thing. Now he says if you can get your freedom, certainly take it. And if you're bought with a price, 1 Corinthians 7, don't be the slaves of man, but recognize that if you are saved while a slave, you are the Lord's freed man. And if you're saved while free, you are the Lord's slave. So what is most important to Paul, to the Lord, and ought to be to us, is our spiritual condition. You know, the biblical perspective really is, and I know this is hard to say, but I hope you could say it, it would be better to be a saved slave than a lost boss. And that's kind of the 1 Corinthians 7 approach, and Paul's writing to people who are in this situation, can't change it. Fast forward to historic American slavery, where that already barely tolerable, barely bearable situation is now further complicated, further corrupted with kidnapping, or we would say man-stealing or human trafficking, racism, and just prevalent abuse. And those things weren't part of first American Greco-Roman slavery. It was not race-based. It had nothing to do with skin color or anything like that, or people of nations that had been conquered as the Roman Empire expanded, people born into this, people selling themselves into this situation. It was not, you know, so the Bible clearly condemns human trafficking, kidnapping, man-stealing, racism, all of those things. So it would be a mistake to do as some who called themselves Christians did in the 15th to 19th century, to point to passages like Ephesians 6 to justify historic American slavery, because it's not the same situation. Rather, we could do what like the Wesleys and the Wilberforces of the world did, to take passages like this actually as the seeds for the reform, for abolition, and so forth, was the right way to take this. So let's fast forward into present day, you know, Indianapolis, modern American employment, and I've got equal opportunity, hiring and disability payment and unemployment payment and OSHA and workman's comp and you know, retirement packages and unions and all of these things. So can we take what these instructions are about to be and apply them to our situation as modern day American employees? Well, I would argue that if Paul could ask this of a person in first century Greco-Roman slavery, to behave in these ways, and we'll see it's like a wholehearted, sincere, respectful obedience, then we, in much better circumstances, who have it so much easier, and in fact have the freedom in most cases to leave one place of employment and try to find some other situation, we should be at least as ready, at least as eager, at least as able to follow these instructions. So our main application today is going to be take these instructions to servants and apply them to employees, and the instructions to masters and apply them to overseers, supervisors, employers. And I think that's a legitimate thing to do, because we do actually have an easier time with that than the original audience did. As many as 1/3 of the population of first century of Ephesus would have been in this class of the household slave, historians tell us. And since first century Christianity, as it started to grow, appealed really in a bigger way to the oppressed in society. Many women, children, and slaves would have composed the church in even a greater balance. And so there's a third to a half, perhaps, of the congregation in Ephesus whose ears perk up when Paul turns his instructions toward them. So kind of for frame of reference, if you take that first century Greco-Roman slavery compared to modern American employment, kind of halfway between is your Downton Abbey, if that helps anybody, just to kind of make a frame of reference. Well, many people through the world in different ages of history have been in these conditions that are worse than ours. And you say, well, you don't know where I work, but some historical perspective there. All right, so let's get into it then. What are these instructions? We've got to keep reading past those first nine words, and it's going to involve first to servants. He addresses the servants first, just as he addressed wives first, children first, in those relationships. Serve respectfully. Serve respectfully. Starting again in verse 5, servants, be obedient to them that are your masters according to the flesh. And notice that qualifier that makes so much difference. Your masters according to the flesh. It's recognizing this is just your earthly master, your human master, your temporary person who's in this position of being a master. It's not your true master. You have a heavenly master. But if you find yourself with a master according to the flesh, obey them with fear and trembling. All right, so here's this idea of serving respectfully. And we see fear and trembling, and it's like, well, you know, somebody who's like just terrified. But that's kind of just an intensified way of talking about respect. When Paul writes to the Corinthians, he says, when I came to you, I didn't come with you know, proud speech or lofty wisdom, but I came with fear and trembling. It's just kind of a meek, humble respect for the position of another. In 2 Corinthians, he commends the Corinthian church because they received Titus with fear and trembling. It's not that the believers in Corinth were scared of Titus. They just humbly, meekly recognized his position and showed some respect toward him. Or even Paul will write and say, work out your salvation with fear and trembling. There's this reverence toward the Lord that doesn't cause us to literally quake, but causes a deep reverential respect. And so in chapter 5, verse 22, submit to one another in the fear, same word, of Christ. Or chapter 5 and verse 33, wives, see that you reverence your husband. It's actually the same word there that's translated fear in chapter 6. It's just a meek, respectful recognition of that other person's position. Though, to be sure, many slaves did have good reason to literally fear their masters in this context. But if mom leaves, teens, mom leaves for a few hours, says, here's what you need to get done before I get back. All right, when you hear the garage door open and there's that fear and trembling, that's kind of the reverential respect for the position of another, not necessarily a fear for your well-being or a terror of the person. Serve wholeheartedly is the instruction for those in the role of one who is under authority. You know, as you go to work, as you answer to different people, serve respectfully, serve wholeheartedly. Verse 5 says, with fear and trembling, in singleness of your heart. In singleness of your heart. So it's not like you're doing it half-heartedly. It's not like, well, you've got ulterior motives, or you smile at the boss, but inside, you know, you're thinking about how you'd like to, you know, get back at the, you know, this coworker, that situation. Wholehearted service means, like Ecclesiastes 9:10 says, whatsoever your hand finds to do, do it with all your might. And this is actually God's will for you. As you find yourself in a position of service under the authority of another, with fear and trembling in singleness of your heart as unto Christ, verse 6, not with eye service as men pleasers, but as the servants of Christ, doing the will of God. So it's God's will, and notice how the verse ends, from the heart. So this is a wholehearted type of service that you, in your day-to-day, as you work, as you labor, as you answer to those in authority over you, it's a wholehearted kind of work, and this is God's will, verse 6 says. Remember back in chapter 5 and verse 17, it talks about how instead of being unwise. We've got to be wise and discern what God's will is. That's a spirit-filled walk, is doing what pleases God. What is God's will? And then he specifically addresses that a chapter later to those in a position of being under authority in their work to understand that it is God's will that you offer wholehearted service, respectful service to those you find yourselves under the authority of. Not with eye service. Not with eye service, verse 6, as men pleasers. So this type of mentality in the workplace, serving respectfully, serving wholeheartedly, is going to set you apart from a high percentage of other people in the workforce, right? Do you have coworkers who only work or only work hard when the supervisor comes around? And it's like, oh, look busy, here comes the boss. That's eye service. It's not really working from the heart, it's working for someone else's eyes. Another way you could be guilty of eye service is when it's like, okay, I've done my job externally. I've gone through all the motions of being where I'm supposed to be, saying what I'm supposed to say, doing what I'm supposed to do, and then I'm out of here. I wasn't mentally engaged. I wasn't spiritually engaged. It was an outward thing for eye service. The spirit-filled employee, the spirit-filled servant, doesn't work just for that external recognition of checking boxes, but rather does it all from the heart. And the motivation for that wholehearted servitude is recognizing, so the boss would say, put your back into it, right? Put your back into it. Paul says, put your heart into it. And it's both. And so the reason you could have that kind of wholehearted, respectful, pouring yourself into even manual, lowly or boring or whatever it is type of work, is that you are doing it as a ministry to Christ. And that's really Paul's primary emphasis as he's talking to servants, is serve as a ministry to Christ. Your work can be ministry. Last week we talked about it's easy to be one person at church and someone else at home. And it's easy to be one person at church and someone else at work, too. Because in our minds, we can compartmentalize and think that church is a Sunday thing. The church is Christ's body. Can you be part of a body one day a week? How about if your left foot takes 6 days off, every week, right? Instead of seeing my identity as a church member as this Sunday thing where Sunday has like a sacred, elevated moral behavior attached to it, but Monday through Saturday are my secular days. That's so unbiblical. And we kind of fall into that just because of the way our schedules are built, because we have protected Sunday as a Lord's Day for worship, and the other days we are working and studying in the secular world. And so what can happen is that external situation I find myself in can kind of cause me to slip internally into different attitudes, different really identities almost, like I'm switching hats. And the biblical perspective is that as you clock in, that factory job or that cubicle, wherever you find yourself tomorrow morning, that your ministry is continuing, that you are a member of Christ's body 24/7, and what you do in your work or your other ways that you relate to people in positions of authority over you is a ministry for Christ. It does speak of what the Christian ethic, the Christian conduct. I know one believer who was in a position of supervising, and he talked about new employees, and it was almost like when you're here, you know who you are. You have these employees where when they say, oh, I'm a Christian, it was almost a red flag for this supervisor. Obviously, you want everyone to know Christ, But not everyone who says that has a true relationship with the Lord. And a lot of people who said that, it was just a prelude for, I'm going to need this special treatment. I'm going to need that exemption. I'm going to need all the weekends off. I'm going to need this. I'm not going to be expected to do this or that. And it's almost like we could be the stickler in the workplace, but the Spirit-filled servant is the one who is the light in the workplace, who excels, who puts their heart into it, because we recognize it's for Jesus. People are to see a difference in us in the workplace. Sometimes we can't always like witness, share the gospel on the clock, as it were. But Warren Wiersbe says, so the best witness for Christ is the one who puts in a full good day's work. We are representing Jesus. We are his body throughout the earth, shining forth, and the way to do it is with a respectful, wholehearted service that is ultimately motivated by pleasing the Lord. It's all by and for and through Jesus. Remember this list last week? We looked at how in all our relationships it works this way. So submit to one another. Why? Because each other is so special? No, verse 22 of chapter 5, because it's in the fear of Christ. Wives, verse 23, submit to your husbands. Why? Because husbands are better or special or something like that? No, it's for the Lord. Husbands, love as Christ loved. Children, obey in the Lord. Fathers, nurture in the admonition of the Lord. And then we included this one, servants, obey as unto Christ, verse 5. But notice verse 6, not with eye service as men pleasers, but as the servants of Christ. And notice verse 7, with good will, doing service as to the Lord and not to men. As Paul, highlights this in each of these earthly relationships, and especially those where it's in a hard spot, if I'm having to submit to someone who, is not always worthy of that kind of honor, remember it's for the Lord. And it's so important, especially in this position of servitude, that Paul felt the need to reiterate it and reiterate it and reiterate it and to three times remind that person under authority that what you're doing isn't because your boss is so special or your manager deserves it. It is for Jesus. That's how you can serve wholeheartedly when you keep that picture foremost in your approach, your mentality, on the clock, in the workplace, or in other positions where you're under authority out in the world, that you are serving Jesus through that. As you do well, as you, as verse 7 says, with good will do that service. It's for Jesus. You can sweep floors for Jesus, yes. Serve respectfully, serve wholeheartedly, serve as a ministry to Christ. And Peter's going to add, not only to the good and gentle, but also to the froward, the perverse, the twisted, the wicked. Hard to do. Hard to do. So if you read these four verses and it's like, wow, Paul's just kind of, the servants are in this tough place and Paul just tells them to work harder and give their all. It's almost like he's favoring the establishment and keeping the help happy and hardworking so that those in power can benefit from it. What's going on here? Until he drops the bomb that is verse 9 and begins to instruct masters. Servants, do this, this, and this. All right, masters, you've got one verse and it's basically this. Same goes for you. And that would have been such a shock to the first century culture. But look at verse 9. And ye masters, do the same things unto them. Because remember what this is all flowing from? Chapter 5 and verse 22, submit to one another in the fear of Christ. Yes, the wife submits to the husband. Guess what? The husband, love, gives his life and lays it down so that the wife can flourish. Yes, the children are obeying the parents, but remember, the father is, rather than making his children angry, to really pour himself into investing in their growth. And yes, the servant is in a position of authority under the master, but guess what? The master is to, as a slave of Christ and a servant to others and a respecter of others, to really pour himself into those that he works over and alongside. It's not that, everyone kind of switches name tags and the hourly employees now run the business, but what he's talking about is that masters, you ought to serve respectfully. You ought to work wholeheartedly. You ought to see your work, your labor, your activity in the workforce as a ministry for Christ, just as the servant is instructed to do. Someone is under your authority. If you're going to serve respectfully with and over that person, remember that's a human in God's image with a family and with feelings and with dignity and worth. That's not your, asset. Or he would tell the first century person, that's not your property. That is your, and if it's a saved person, that's your brother. That's your sister. That is someone to show Christ to. When you remember what James says, that masters will receive the greater condemnation than maybe, supervisor, manager, maybe you could have some fear and trembling too when you keep that in mind. Wholeheartedly, don't patronize, don't condescend, but take sincere interest in those that are under your authority. Talking to a lot of people here who have influence, have, teams working under you, people, under your influence, these kinds of behaviors that show Christ to them in the way that you lead is a ministry to Christ. It's a ministry to Christ. Is this biblical to, you could see how as I'm relating to someone in authority over me, okay, God has allowed that person to be in that position of authority, so by submitting to that authority, I'm submitting to God. And we can kind of see that trajectory. It's a little harder to say, okay, so I as an employer, as a manager, as a supervisor, as a business owner, am to treat other people as I'm treating the Lord? Can you treat someone who the world would see as under you and treat that person like Christ? Well, in Jesus' parable, where in the parable of the king, the master represents Christ, the king says in that parable, in so much as you have done it to the least of one of these, my brethren, what's the rest of the verse? You have done it unto me. Yes, you can serve that person under you, treat them like Jesus. It doesn't mean you're, again, that you're switching responsibilities, but it means there is a valuing that other person, a humble approach to that other person. It's not really something you'll read about in the Business World magazine so much. But it's for Jesus. He's the origin of why, my motivation, why I'm doing it. And I'm treating that person as if they're Jesus in a way so that they are actually the, Jesus is at the beginning, is at the end, as Klein Snodgrass puts it. He's the origin and the recipient of every act is Jesus. He's the for the Christian, for the Spirit-filled believer, Jesus is the origin and the recipient of every act I'm doing. It's all by Jesus, and it's all for Jesus. To continue that quote, if this is true, if this is true, no act is mundane and no person is unimportant. If Jesus is the origin and the recipient of all of my acts, then no job, no act is mundane. Every moment is sacred. Every act is ministry. Every person is important. So there's a put off, a renewal, and a putting on. The behavior the master is to put on is to show humility, show respect, show love, show Christ-likeness. But the put off comes in verse 9. Forbearing, threatening. And ye masters, do the same things unto them. Forbearing, threatening. That means stop threatening. Don't use threats as a motivation any longer. And in that first century context, it could have been threats of beatings, threats of imprisonment, threats of selling and dividing a family and putting someone in a harsher circumstance or even death. And Paul says that is not Christ-like. That is not Spirit-filled behavior. That is not seeing that person that you lead as Christ or in a Christian way. Remember, the end of verse 9, knowing that your master is also in heaven. Neither is there any respect of persons with him. The secular world sees entry-level, hourly pay, part-timer, and then there's a ladder of supervisor and manager and CEO and owner and board member and all of these things, and there's these strata. God doesn't see it that way. Employer, remember, ultimately, you're not the boss. You've got a master too. And there's no respect of persons with him. The perspective is so much different from heaven than it is from the cubicle, from the business standpoint. We were driving, I was taking the kids to school this week. The kids look out the window, and there's like a full moon. I don't know if it was a full moon this week or nearly full, but it was clear in the sky. And here comes a jet flying through the sky. And from the car, it looks like the jet is headed right toward the moon. You know, one of the kids in the back seat goes, "Look, that plane's about to land on the moon." And it's like, it's going right toward it. And then it comes and it goes right over. Oh, missed. You know, and a couple of them are old enough to recognize. The others, it sure looks like that from the window, but there is such a gap there. If you could have the perspective. So one of the kids asked, "So, Dad, would the moon look closer, though, to the person in the plane? As the person in the plane looks out the window compared to how we look out the window, would the moon look closer from the plane?" And it's like, you know, maybe in like the tiniest fraction, but really in our perception, you know, you look out the window of a plane at the moon, it looks the same. And so I said, it actually works better in this room than it does in the car. I said, if the ceiling is the moon, and this is us in our car, the plane is here. Right? And so if the moon was looking down, it's like, oh, look, that plane is landing on Earth. Oh, it didn't quite land. And it's like the plane and the car, tiny specks, no difference at all. So you are putting through life, putting through your career in, you know, your car, quarter million miles, old enough to vote. And there's that person in that jet, and it seems like, oh man, that's such a big gap. But from heaven's perspective, there's no gap at all. There is no respect of persons with him. Doesn't make it holier to be poor. Doesn't make it wrong to be rich or fly in planes. Sorry. But understand that these are not rankings of value or worth or dignity of any, or any such thing. So let's prescribe this then. If we want to be healthy and behave in spirit-filled ways, it's going to involve four behaviors that we'll discuss here in ending. One, join the distinguished ranks of servanthood. From a biblical perspective, and you can read Romans 6, we are all slaves. And I know it's an ugly word and it's hard to think that way, but it's spiritually true. You are either a slave to sin or you're a slave to Christ. And we come into this world enslaved by sin. No one had to teach you to lie and hit and hate and steal and all of those things. We come in slaves to sin. And that's hard, that doesn't seem right, but the right comes when Jesus gave his life to redeem you from that slavery so that you can be freed from the chains of sin. Have you become Christ's slave? Or are you still a slave to sin? Oh, I'm not a slave. That's not an option. You're a slave to sin or you're a slave to Christ. And the enslavement to sin is lulling you to sleep. It seems like you're in control of your life. You're not. Can you go a week without saying anything unkind or untruthful or that shouldn't have been said? You're not in control. Oh, you have some level of will, of volition, but you're a slave to sin until the time you're born again. What does Jesus say to Nicodemus? Unless a man be born again, he can't see the kingdom of heaven. You're in the kingdom of darkness where you're a slave there. And you keep running back to it and it dominates your life and it robs you of peace. until in faith you turn to Christ and say, Jesus paid for my freedom, and I trust His death on the cross as payment for my sin so that I can raise from the grave with Him to new spiritual life. Have you been freed from the slave market of sin? Have you been born again, converted, liberated? This is what Jesus offers. And until in faith you receive that, you remain in slavery to sin, no matter how spiritually minded you may see yourself, no matter how moral, how good you think you are. Our righteousness is as filthy rags, but Christ's righteousness can be imputed to us so that we have His robes of a freed man. We are all under authority. So servanthood is a distinguished rank when we all hold it. We're all equal in that respect. Many of our Bible heroes endured slavery for at least part of their lives. Think of Joseph in the Old Testament, sold into slavery. Moses, Aaron and Miriam, not Moses so much, but his brother and sister, slaves from a human earthly perspective. In some degree, Daniel, Nehemiah, Esther knew what it was to be in that type of situation. But ultimately, Jesus is the one who sets an example for us to follow. He set the example of how to be a giving spouse by giving His life on the cross for His bride, the church. He set the example of how to be a child that honors and obeys his parents by subjecting himself to Mary and Joseph. And He shows how to be an obedient, respectful, wholehearted servant by doing what Paul says in Philippians 2 is kind of, in a way, Paul's version of the Christmas story of Jesus coming, and he says He took on Him the form of a doulos, a slave, and made Himself obedient to death. Jesus obeyed all the way, even to the death of a cross. Whosoever shall be chief among you, He told His disciples, let him be your doulos, your servant. At the Last Supper He had with those 12 men, He did the task of a household servant, wrapping a towel around Himself and wiping their feet. And then He said to them, I have given you an example that ye should do as I have done unto you. Join the distinguished ranks of servanthood. He said elsewhere, the servant's not above his master. If Jesus could stoop and serve those the world would say are far below Him, then you can adopt the posture of a servant so that you could one day stand before Christ and hear the Lord say unto you, well done. These are the words of Matthew 25:21. Well done, thou good and faithful doulos, slave, servant. You have been faithful over a few things. I will make thee ruler over many things. Enter thou into the joy of the Lord. So last week we talked about big picture parenting. Well, what would it look like to be a big picture servant or a big picture leader? Well, verse 5 says it's masters according to the flesh. So I'm remembering the big picture that my relationship to this person in authority is only earthly. It's only temporary. It's not my ultimate position in God's eyes. That's seeing the big picture. It's recognizing, as Harold Honer says, Christianity does not promise a release from the present circumstances, but gives one power to endure those circumstances. That's the big picture. God isn't going to take my difficult situation away at work, maybe, but He is going to give me strength to endure that and to serve wholeheartedly and for Christ in that scenario. Salvation doesn't give us a new position in earthly terms, but it ought to give us a new disposition. Or as Wiersbe says, it's not a new organization, but it's a new motivation. In my Bible, next to verse 5, servants, be obedient to them that are your masters. I have a red line and the word unfair. Next to verse 6, where it says, not with eye service and as men pleasers, but as the servants of Christ, doing the will of God from the heart. And my red line continues with the word unfair. And next to verse 7, with good will, doing service as unto the Lord and not to men. That red line continues with the word unfair. Wait, should a preacher write unfair in his Bible next to Bible verses? Verse 8 says, knowing that whatsoever good things any man doeth, the same shall he receive of the Lord, whether he be bond or free. And there I've got a green line with the word fair, exclamation point. Verse 5, verse 6, verse 7 are difficult to endure. They are imbalanced and at times unjust. But God will make it all right someday. Recognizing that is the eye-opening perspective of big picture servanthood. Of knowing that, no, my boss, who is definitely not Jesus, I can treat him as he is, in the sense that I am obeying for Jesus' sake. In my work situation that is far from perfect, I can pour myself into it, because everything I do here, though it's unfair, I will someday receive back from the Lord. Think about the difference between what we endure here and what the Lord will bless with there. Verse 8, one more time, whatsoever good thing any man doeth, the same shall he receive from the Lord, whether he be bond or free. Heavenly reward is not dependent on earthly status. Look at the story of the rich man and Lazarus. Your master also is in heaven. There's this heavenly focus to the big picture that says, you know, this, what I see here and what I experience and what I endure is not the whole story. This is the prelude. It's kind of the where I'm investing now for what will be a reality then. Servant or master, slave or free, male or female, rich or poor, you know, husband or wife, parent or child, these distinctions make a difference in your earthly role and responsibilities, but they make no difference in your value, your essence, your worth, your dignity, your standing before God, or your eternal reward. God will balance it all in his time. Galatians 3:28, neither bond nor free, slave or free, male or female, rich or poor, Greek or Jew, all are one in Christ. So you go to work, and you work hard, but it's not noticed. It's not appreciated. In fact, you're passed over for the promotion. In fact, you don't get that raise. Remember my first job? It was such menial, you know, kind of a boring labor situation. And they told me after a year, there's a raise after 1 year. And, you know, that kept me going about a month and a half in. You know, okay, if I can get that 12 months, and that kept me going 9 months in, 10 months in. I got to the year mark, and my wages went from $5 an hour to $5.05 an hour. And you might be in underappreciated, undercompensated situations where working harder means for you, they give you more jobs to do. And that can just burden us with so much, you know, frustration, until we remember God's going to make it right. Everything you give to the Lord, whatsoever good thing any man doeth, verse 8, the same shall he receive from the Lord. And masters, you know, verse 8 is a segue. It's any man that doeth good. So it segues into the masters. Hey, same goes for you. It's the idea, if you stop threatening your employees and now production goes down, guess what? God's going to take care of you. And if you show your employees gentleness and respect and love and they burn you, guess what? God's going to take care of you. Every good thing the Lord will give back. Your situation is temporary. Your impact is eternal. That's big picture servitude or big picture leadership. quickly see beyond social strata. There are more slaves alive today than in any other period in history around parts of the world. And that doesn't include millions of women and children in sweatshops and poor conditions that go home with pennies. If we have an opportunity to do something about this, whether it's prayer or getting involved and or giving or things like that, there are situations in our country where minorities and underprivileged members of society face disadvantages. We need to be sensitive to this and to the hurt that it creates. See where we might be involved. Quote Snodgrass again, "We tend to show favoritism to the rich and powerful and to show little respect to the poor and powerless. Both are sins." End quote. I want to say it again. We tend to show favoritism to the rich and powerful and show little respect to the poor and powerless. Both are sins. See beyond social strata. Don't scoff or bristle toward those who talk about underprivilege or oppression. A Christian ethic dictates sympathy, empathy, compassion as we seek to treat people with dignity and respect. So it was in the 1840s that a hymn writer put together words for a song we sing at Christmas time in a stanza that says, "Truly he taught us to love one another. His law is love, and his gospel is peace. Chains shall he break, for the slave is our brother, and in his name all oppression shall cease." Jesus cares a great deal how we treat each other, his creatures who bear his image, and we will be held accountable. Finally, live, serve, and lead for an audience of one. You can walk out of here and go, "Really, this, I don't know if any of that's going to work for me tomorrow morning when I go to work." You know, that wholehearted business, that respectful stuff, doing it like for Jesus, I don't know if that applies. I don't know if that can even be done. I can't. And the answer is, you can't do this unless you're Spirit-filled. At times, masters, employees are going to ask too much of you or be uncaring in the way that they ask. Think back to chapters 1 through 3. And all Christ has done for you. Could he ever ask too much of you? Because what that employee asks of you, unless he's telling you to, that employer asks of you, unless she's telling you to sin, Jesus is asking it of you. Could he ask too much? Wives, as you relate to your husbands, if it's for Jesus, could Jesus ask too much? Husbands, for your wives. Children, as you're obeying your parents and they ask so much, could Jesus ask too much? Because Jesus asks this of you. Parents, could Jesus ask too much when he tells you to pour into the investment of your children? Employees, you may be called to, if you start around 15 or 20 and work till you're 65 or 70, 50 years in the workforce. Now, some of you 20, 30, 40 years in the workforce. Original audience of Paul's letter, you know, maybe 70, 80 years in this position of slavery. Over the course of that time, enduring various levels of injustice or abuse or neglect or lack of compensation or undercompensation, is that fair? But if you voluntarily embrace these duties and roles with an attitude, a mentality, a spirit-filledness, a wholeheartedness as service to Christ, Jesus will spend eternity making it up to you. Is that fair? Live, serve, and lead for an audience of one. Let's bow together.